everybody. Welcome to the Chat About Children podcast, where we explore topics that help families, caregivers, and educators support the growth and development of our youngest generation. I am Bailey Shelton, the Director of Communications and Outreach for the Children's Foundation of Mississippi, and I am so excited to have y'all join us today for a very important and timely conversation about infant and child mental health. This podcast episode today is made in part by Mississippi Lift, which is an initiative in which the Children's Foundation of Mississippi is a partner. Mississippi Lift's mission is to equip families, communities, and child care providers with the tools that they need to nurture and support Mississippi's children. And today's episode focuses on mental health in infants and young children, which is an area that does not often receive the attention it deserves, but this is so crucial to lifelong well-being. I'm honored to be joined by two exceptional guests, Dr. Gabrielle Banks and Dr. Courtney Walker, both licensed clinical psychologists with a wealth of expertise in child development and mental health. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We're glad to be here.
I'm going to jump on in. And first, I want to start out kind of getting a foundational understanding of child mental health. So, in y'all's opinion, what are the key factors that influence mental health development in infants and young children?
I can take that one. But first, I just, again, want to thank you guys for having us. And we are going to be real informal today because I love talking about this. I love talking about infant early childhood mental health. And it's always present on my mind just because what I do professionally. But I'm also a mom. A newish mom. I have an almost 2-year-old, and then I have a 7-week-old like in my arms while we are talking. So it is very present for me and grounds me in the work a little bit better because I can experience it firsthand. So, you know, when we talk about infant and early childhood mental health, a lot of people are like, what do you mean? Like, babies don't have mental health. Toddlers don't have mental health. And I think we tend to forget that they are little humans. They are people. They are actually having a whole lot of a harder time than we are because they are new to the world. They are learning everything for the first time. They have no practice in dealing with frustration or sadness or happiness or excitement. It's all very new, and it's all very hard to learn how to deal with that and regulate and function. So I think it's important that we remember that these little people are people. They're human. They experience emotion just like we do. It's just kind of different. And so if for people who are questioning, like, do babies have mental health? Do toddlers have mental health? Of course they do. We do. So do they. So, but what influences infant and early childhood mental health? It's kind of what influences our mental health and how we function. So biological factors influence our mental health. So if we come into the world, if a baby comes into the world a little early, may have had some difficulty in utero, maybe have been exposed to things that maybe babies shouldn't be exposed to that can, you know, change how their brain develops. That sets a foundation, a biological foundation for mental health, but it's absolutely not the end all be all. So, you know, there's environmental factors that are arguably, I think Dr. Banks would agree with me, more important than the biological factors. And that includes a physical environment. So where the baby lives, if the environment is safe, If the physical environment is free of things that are not safe to babies, like mold and lead and those sorts of things, but also a relational environment or a caregiving environment. And that's really where Dr. Banks and I focus the most in our clinical work, is making that caregiving and relational environment the most optimal it can be to promote little ones' mental health. A caregiving environment can be a parent. It can be a teacher, a daycare worker. It can be a grandparent, an aunt. But what we strive for in those caregiving or relational environments is warmth, consistency. A baby or toddler needs to know what they expect from you all the time. If things are kind of chaotic and changing from moment to moment, they can't really ground themselves and feel safe to explore new things. that's obviously going to impact how they develop and how they experience emotion and regulate their little bodies too. And, you know, within the caregiving environment, it also includes how the caregiver themselves feel. So not only how they are interacting with their baby, but how they feel themselves, because that, I mean, that's, you can't separate the two. So if you have a mom, for example, who is experiencing postpartum depression after she had a pretty maybe difficult birth or something like that, she's not able to read her baby. She's struggling with understanding what their cues mean. So what is a hunger cue? What is a tired cue? What is a I poop my pants and I really need you to get it off my butt cue? And so all those things impact that baby's ability to regulate their little bodies, get to a calm state. And so that's a really broad answer to that question, but, you know, both things are very influential. But I think, you know, Dr. Banks and I, again, we really go back to the relational caregiving environment as being one of the most important factors that influences mental health development in young children.
So to follow up with on that one, how does caregiver stress or mental health impact a child's development? And what can a caregiver do to make sure that their stress or mental health is not impacting the child? Or what kind of resources are available for caregivers or adults who work with young children?
So caregiver mental health and caregiver stress impacts the domains that Dr. Walker just mentioned. So not only does it impact the biological aspect of life, but it also impacts the environmental aspect of life. And so we recognize that when mothers or birthing parents are experiencing high levels of stress or mental health challenges, it can impact the brain structures of the babies that are growing inside of them. And specifically, that those levels of stress impact the structures of the areas of the brain that that control memory and learning and processing emotion. In addition to that, that caregiver environment that Dr. Walker was mentioning is increasingly impacted by caregiver stress and their ability to regulate their emotions and their ability to manage difficult emotions. And as Dr. Walker was saying, the social emotional development of children is dependent on the social and emotional health of their first teachers, their parents. And so the example of reading cues impacts attachment and bonding with an infant. It impacts the way that children learn how to manage adversity. Again, getting back to this combination of their brain structure and the experiences that they have in their environment. So we recognize that when caregivers and parents are at a high level of stress, that increases inconsistent responses to their children. It also increases the likelihood of an unstable environment. And we know that children need stability in their environment and predictability in their environment in order to feel safe. And we grow when we have our basic safety needs met. And so we want to make sure that we're supporting caregivers and birthing parents in these first 12 months of life, at the very least. But specifically, we also know that caring for young children can be extremely taxing, especially for new parents. It's one of those pieces where we want to make sure that we're not putting the onus on the adult to take care of themselves and do it all on their own. And that can be very dangerous because they are likely already feeling extremely overwhelmed because they are the ones who are now in charge of the safety and well-being of this small child. But making sure that we are advocating for birthing parents and moms, advocating for their mental health care, advocating for ways that they can increase their self-care while still making sure that we are following guidelines that they set for in terms of their cultural background, in terms of their life goals, and in terms of the general path that they have taken in life. And that specifically means that it's not saying, oh, well, you can just ask such and such for help. Just ask your mom for help. We recognize that not everyone has a relationship with their mother to where they might be comfortable asking their mother for help caring for their child. So making sure that we're asking parents who is in their social sphere that they would be comfortable asking for help. And in addition to that, as healthcare professionals, we are connecting them with resources, specifically resources just for adults and adult mental health, and even resources for mothers and mother support groups and resources for new moms as well.
And can y'all give me an example of what good mental health looks like in infants and toddlers, and maybe a sign of mental health challenges that parents should be aware of?
So I will say, I'll start with the challenges first, or what we want families to be on the lookout for. And I think Dr. Walker could give us some really good examples of what good mental health looks like for young children. But I will say that the main piece is that we want to give families a little bit of cut them some slack. Sometimes it's hard to read. Sometimes cues from babies can go overlooked and can be missed because there are a lot of different experiences that babies are having. Babies are supposed to cry. Babies are supposed to get frustrated really easily when they don't understand things. Babies and toddlers as well. They are supposed to want to be close to their primary caregivers and have challenges when they're separating from their caregivers. That's all developmentally appropriate and expected. And sometimes babies have challenges soothing themselves and they have challenges falling asleep. But when we see a high level and high frequency of these challenges, so much so that it impacts and negatively impacts their ability to engage in other activities we deem developmentally appropriate, then we would say we're looking at some emotional challenges or maybe some challenges with anxiety or mood that we want to take a deeper look at. Specifically, if a baby is crying so much that they're unable to eat and so take in the calories that they need to take in, if they are so upset that they are unable to enjoy or even engage with activities or items in their environment, that would be an example of a child who is having significant difficulties regulating even more so than we would expect. And so we ask parents to look for patterns of behavior. Not just a baby who cries a lot, but a baby who cries so much that they can't get through tummy time. They aren't able to engage and meet the milestones we would expect.
I was just going to jump in and add too. We also look for caregiver impairment, family impairment. So a baby can't tell you, "Hey, I'm really struggling. This is causing me impairment in my daily life." So we have to look to infant behavior, but impacting the caregiving relationship too. So take Dr. Banks's example of a baby who's crying really excessively, like can't eat, can't do tummy time, just a really colicky baby. That is going to impact a mother's, potentially, or a birthing parent's ability to regulate themselves. When you have an infant who's crying all the time, you're not going to feel good about yourself as a parent because you're going to feel like, I don't know what I'm doing. I can't help my baby. What's happening? You're going to probably feel frustrated too. There's only so much crying you can listen to as a sleep deprived person before you lose your cool too. And it can also impact things like feeding. Like if you're breastfeeding and your baby is just crying all the time and you can't get them to latch, again, that's going to go back to, I feel like I'm failing my baby because I can't feed them. I can't make them calm or soothe. What the heck am I doing? So that's going to impact my mental health too, which is then going to impact my baby because I'm not reading their cues right. I'm not helping them regulate because I'm stressed out myself. So that's another thing that we look at too, is how much is the caregiver, the family impacted by what's going on with the baby as well.
That was affirming to hear that developmentally appropriate behavior for infants is when they're upset that they're not with their primary caregiver. You know, when people say they're just manipulating you to want to be with you, it's affirming to hear what you're saying, that is a developmentally appropriate thing. They should want to be with you, and it's appropriate and important to give them that attention.
I was just going to mention that, especially at that transition from around between 9 months and really 15 or 16 months, these are times when when children are starting to recognize this idea of what we call object permanence, that someone exists or something exists even when it's not in my sight. So that's the time when separation anxiety from moms is at its height. And so that is, again, that's typically we see that in a typically developing child that would be developmentally appropriate. If we, and that might be a prolonged time of crying and distress, but generally they're able to regulate and calm themselves down before mom returns. What we say is about 15 minutes to calm down. If it's going longer than that, especially for older children, then we are a little bit more concerned. Or this is a child who has not learned how to calm themselves down, maybe because mom always comes back. So they haven't had the opportunity to learn that grown-ups come back, as Daniel Tiger says. A little bit, again, is acceptable and what we would expect. But when we see impairment, that's when we would say that we're looking at a more significant challenge.
I was just going to add what would be an indicator of adaptive mental health in a young child. But if we see the opposite, like if a young child isn't having a reaction to their caregiver leaving, that can also be a sign that, hey, something might be going on, because we expect that. We expect for when a mom of a 18-month-old walks out of the room and leaves a baby with a, I don't know, it doesn't have to be a stranger, but a grandparent, maybe they don't get to see that often. They get upset because that one person who they trust, who is secure, who I know will take care of me, has left the room, and oh my gosh, what's going to happen? When we don't see that, is when we might be tuned into something happening relationally between the caregiver and the child. So is this an instance where the child has learned that mom leaves all the time and doesn't come back, and so I've just kind of learned that this just happens and it is what it is, and then I'm going to go to this complete stranger for comfort because I'm not used to getting it from my parent? That's also a something that we would kind of cue in and try to explore a little more. Because at that age, we would also want to see some hesitance in going towards a complete stranger for comfort. That's actually could be dangerous to the child to always seek out comfort from a stranger. So when we don't see that, that can be a sign of mental health that needs some support and help in a young child.
Just briefly add on to what optimal development looks like. And this is pretty broad, but these are children who are able to explore and learn in their environment without fear of punishment. So they are eager to explore and look into things and open up things and peer and look around. They're able to form close and secure relationships with their primary caregivers, and they're able to warm to other people after they've been established to be a safe person. So one thing I do is that if I'm meeting a new toddler, if I'm meeting a new baby, I'm not running straight up to that little baby as cute as they are. I want to make sure that they know that, you know, well, my mom or my dad is talking to this person, so they must be an okay person. And so this is a child who's able to recognize that, oh, okay, well, you know, my main person thinks you're okay, so I might let you wave at me, or I might let you touch my foot. But that would be an example of a child who is warming in an appropriate time and taking appropriate steps to warm. These are children who, similar to what Dr. Walker was saying, demonstrate a full range of emotions. So we should see happiness, and we should see sadness, and we should see a little bit of fear at unexpected situations that are typical unexpected situations. So if there's a loud noise in another room, we would expect them to startle and look at their parents as if to say, did you hear that too? What's going on here? Questioning expression. So we would expect them to have all of that full range of emotion. And they're able to do it within the context of their family and their community and their culture. And as we said before, healthy babies cry. Healthy babies can sometimes be harder to soothe. There's a wide range there of babies who just have different temperaments, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're having mental health struggles. They're just a little bit more challenging to soothe than their big brother or their big sister was. That still does not mean that there is something particularly wrong with a baby. And again, overall, babies are able to engage in the activities that we would expect for their age range, and specifically related to developmental milestones, related to communication and fine motor skills and gross motor skills, and also play. They're able to spend that time and enjoy that time in their environment. That would be an example of a happy and a healthy baby.
What is the difference, and or is there one, from poor mental health or neurodivergence? I'm just thinking about those developmental milestones and communication. How can a parent know if their child maybe is simply on the autism spectrum or if they are significantly struggling with their mental health?
So, you know, neurodivergence is still a relatively new term. You know, I think when I went to grad school, that was not something that we were using, and it's been interesting to incorporate into my vocabulary and also into how I think about kids and how they experience things and just normal variation too. Because I think that's part of one aspect of neurodivergence that we tend to kind of ignore, that a lot of folks can be neurodivergent in how they experience the world, how they process information. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there is a clinically significant concern that warrants a diagnosis and treatment and things like that. So the same thing applies to little kids. But so if we did have a young child, or even let's say like a 12-month-old that could be exhibiting some concerning symptoms that would make us want to do some assessment and early intervention to try and improve that, so, you know, they can continue to meet developmental milestones. So one thing that I would definitely look for in a 12-month-old by that point would be something called joint attention. Joint attention is just a person's ability to reference an object, reference back a person, to communicate to them, hey, do you see that? Do you see that? Without actually using words. You know, a 12-month-old who may not have the word for look can look at something, point to it, and look back at a caregiver just to say, look at that thing. That is so cool. So they can initiate it, but they can also respond to it. And so if a caregiver is looking at a cat and wants the kid to look at a cat, they can point to it. They can look at it. They can make a big expression and say, oh, cat, and get the baby to look at it. So that's a very important developmental skill that should be relatively online by 12 months, because and the reason I go to that one is because it is so important for learning. If a child can't orient themselves to an object and a person to see what this is, explain this to me, adult, they're not going to be able to learn new things. They're not going to be able to catch on as quickly as a kid who has that skill pretty easily. So around, you know, 12 months or so, I would expect to see that in a young child. And if we're not seeing that, doesn't necessarily mean that there's the child's on the autism spectrum, but it is a clue into maybe we should look into this. Does the child have a vision issue? Does the child have a hearing issue? Are we just really inattentive and can't focus on things for very long, and what we would expect for a 12-month-old to focus on, to where they just can't quite do that yet? But we would want to assess a little further just to see if that's happening. Another thing I would look for is not necessarily words. I know everyone is really obsessed by, well, they need to have their, you know, their first word by 12 months old. Yes, generally, yes, that's what we want to see. But we also want to see vocalizations before that. They may not actually be a word, but are they using vocalizations like ga ga ga, ba ba ba, da da da, in an almost purposeful way? And again, that's not a word, but they're vocalizations or verbalizations that have communicative intent. So they mean something. They're trying to get their caregiver to focus, to get their attention or something. We would want to see that by 12 months for sure. And if we don't, then that might be something that we need to look into and assess for, again, to connect them to services to improve on that. Obviously, we're not going to change kids and who they are and their temperament and their personality. We celebrate neurodivergence. We celebrate all the different types of kids in the world. But that's where we go back to, is it causing this child clinical impairment? And when we're talking about an infant, we're talking about, is that interrupting their ability to learn new things, to develop, to form close and secure relationships? And if it is, then that's a signal to, okay, we need some early intervention to improve on that. So we can get them to a point where they can continue on their own developmental trajectory and start to learn new skills at their own pace.
I'll also add one piece that was also on the list of concerning behaviors for mental health, but we have to be careful because, as I said, there is a wide range and there could be a number of causes for this, but lack of facial expressions and lack of having a wide range of facial expressions. If a baby often has just kind of a flat affect is what we call it, or are they rarely smiling, even with the presentation of fun items, even with tickles from their caregivers. If it's almost in some ways people might refer to it as vacant, like a vacant stare, or again, just pretty much flat or blunted. Even if they, and blunted would refer to if their expressions are just kind of muted almost. If we're seeing that more often than not, that would be a cause for concern or a cause for more an indicator that further information needs to be gathered. Because is this related to mouth mechanics and muscle tone in the child's face? Is it related to cognitive ability? Or is this pointing to a pervasive developmental disorder that would be diagnosed in the next coming months? What we'll say in general is that when you see one piece that is a cause for concern, this does not necessarily mean that a diagnosis will be given the next day. When you take your child to a professional, the professional is also going to be asking a lot of other questions, because just one symptom is not enough. It's truly a constellation of symptoms that helps us to determine what may be going on with the child. And so again, that's why when you take your child, take your baby to the doctor and they ask questions, they're asking multiple questions about what the baby is able to do. Specifically, since we're talking about neurodivergence, we often associate neurodivergence with an autism diagnosis, even though it can also be associated with ADHD and other just differences in neurodevelopment. But with autism, we are able to see some symptoms of autism as early as 12 to 18 months. We do not diagnose autism that early. We can diagnose autism a little bit closer to 2 years old. But the reason why we don't diagnose at 12 to 18 months is because the range of development and what's appropriate is so wide, and a lot of the behaviors and the presentation that we would need to see that a child has significant challenge in has not come online yet. So when they're not expected to do some of these things that if they were not doing them, we would say that's an indication that they're having challenges with social communication and social reciprocity. So if they are developmentally not in that space based on their communication and their cognition, it would be inappropriate to diagnose a child at that age. So that might clear up some confusion, because I think some parents may hear, oh, I heard you can tell at 12 months. Well, you can't tell. You can start seeing some of those symptoms, but that is the time that you would definitely start to bring it to the attention of your pediatrician. Go ahead and keep your own log to maintain your own mental health. We don't want you to obsess about it. But we would say, just write these pieces down so that when you come for your checkups, you can keep a log and you're building your case for whether or not you would like further assessment later on in the next coming of months, or as the child gets closer to 2 years old.
Yeah. And the other thing too to keep in mind for toddlers is sometimes they do really repetitive stuff that you could think you could Google and say, oh, that means my child's on the spectrum. But no, toddlers are just weird little beings, and they do weird stuff sometimes. They do a lot of repetitive stuff. And that's where we go back to, is that what is expected for a child in that developmental period? So toddlers will repetitively play with certain items. They might like to put things into containers and take them out just because they're learning, like, oh, I can fill out a container and I can dump it out. How cool is that? And they might do that a little bit. And that would be typical for what we would expect for a play behavior, given whatever developmental age that child is. But that's another reason too, is because sometimes toddlers can do things that if a parent Googles it, it's like, well, then that means they're on the spectrum. No. That just means that they may have a repetitive behavior that is often seen in toddlerhood.
Great, thank you. That helped a lot with understanding the difference, because I know that a lot of the work in the early childhood realm right now is in early intervention. There's a lot of focus on that. So interesting to hear about the differences and the overlap in mental health and I guess, is neurodivergence the only word to describe that right now?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the term that people are using. But yeah, that definitely includes neurodevelopment, mental health, infant early childhood mental health includes, it has like a little neurodevelopmental piece to it too. So yeah.
So what can parents or caregivers be doing to foster positive, healthy emotional environments for their children to the best of their capability? And on the flip side, if a child does go through an adverse childhood experience, what can parents or caregivers do to build resilience or help the child overcome that and not, I guess, become stunted due to an adverse childhood experience?
I think it's important to remember that parents and caring adults have everything that they need to create a healthy environment for their children. And that might even mean when they ask someone for help to help unlock some of the things inside of them that they need. But for infants, we know that simple things like constant eye contact. So making sure you're making eye contact with the infant, using a calm tone to correct, and a positive tone to encourage infants, using warm facial expressions and making sure you're using gentle touches. These are what infants thrive on and this is what they need. Connecting and highlighting the positives in their environment. So pointing out, oh, that's a dump truck. That dump truck is dumping some dirt, or that cup is pouring water. Or you picked up a cup in your hand. Pointing that out, using lots of words to describe what the child is doing and describe their safe environment. Also eliminating yelling and fussing and arguments with other adults who are in the home with the child is really important. I think that oftentimes we mistakenly judge parents who send their children or send their infants to go live or spend a significant amount of time with other caregivers, especially if they are in a position where their environment is not the most healthy environment for the child. Oftentimes we just say, well, why don't you just move? Why don't you get out of that environment? Your baby doesn't need to be in that environment. But I think we truly need to celebrate these mothers and caregivers who have said to themselves, I love my baby so much, but I am not in a position to step away from the situation or remove myself from the situation. And it might be a more simple path is to remove my baby from the situation by letting them stay with my sister or letting them stay with my mom or my cousin so that they are in the best environment for them. So no one is yelling or fussing and arguing around them. And so this is a parent who has sacrificed their time with their baby in order for their baby to have the best environment possible. So we truly need to celebrate and support these caregivers who really, they shouldn't be in those situations themselves. And it's less than ideal for them as adults to be in a situation where there's constant arguing and bickering. But when families are able to surround and celebrate and support parents who make these difficult decisions so that their children are in the best environment possible, that is something that I believe we should reframe our thinking about and really saying, oh, wow, mom, you love that baby so much that you want to make sure that they're in the right place. That's what we could do for infants and young children, for children who are in toddlerhood, things like active listening, modeling kindness, responding to their needs quickly and appropriately, setting appropriate limits, and also reflecting their own emotions. I understand that you're sad because you wanted to play more. My answer is still no. So that would be an example of reflecting and validating their emotions. Yes, we love it when we get to play at this playground, but also setting an appropriate limit. It's time to go. That would be a way to make sure that toddlers are recognizing that Well, they do see me. They know that I'm sad. And okay, now this is a limit. And they're learning that this is how life goes. Mommy or daddy or grandma might say that it's time to leave and we have to leave, but they are also recognizing that I'm not happy about it. We're also fostering an environment where children are comfortable expressing their emotions, and there's no such thing as a bad emotion. There's no such thing as big boys or big girls don't cry. We're letting them know that their emotions are safe to be expressed in this environment, and life is still going to continue. You're going to be sad now. You're not going to be sad later. I can also help you to plan to do something fun when we get home. And so we're creating and fostering optimism and an idea that good things will happen in the future. And this big, sad, heavy feeling that I have because we have to leave the playground is not going to last forever. It's also recognizing that they've just been here for 2 or 3 years. They're brand new humans. And the emotion part of their brain, or the part of their brain that processes emotion, is the one that's in control. That logical part is not in control yet because it's still developing. And so oftentimes I'll use the analogy of holding a gallon of water. So as adults, it's pretty easy for us to lift a gallon of water. We've lifted gallons of water for years now. And so we know how to tighten our core muscles, how to contract our muscles in our arms, and we have strong enough muscles to lift it. If we gave a gallon of water to an 18-month-old, they would not be able to lift it. Not only do they not have the muscle strength, they don't know how to prepare themselves to lift it because that's where they are in their development. And so sometimes small things that may seem small to us and easy to us or light work to us, like calming ourselves down because we have to leave the playground, is a humongous task for a small child. And so when we use that perspective and put ourselves in their shoes, I think that caregivers are able to respond to children in the ways that they would like to respond to them, that helps to increase and support their development and emotional well-being.
I feel that so much right now. As a mom to an almost 2-year-old, I am saying, yeah, I would be really frustrated too if I had to stop playing with the tractor and go to school. Man, that would be so frustrating. You know, it's time to go to school. But yes, I feel that so much right now. The struggle is real.
So speaking of those activities, like playing with the trucks, what are the pros and cons of screen time with children? If there are any pros, or what is y'all's, you know, viewpoint on exposure to digital media and child's mental health?
Yeah, I will say this. My perspective has since changed since I have become a mother. But I think at its core, my view on it's still the same. And I think it's important to remember when we talk about screen time, we're just not talking about iPad or the iPhone or whatever. Screen time also includes television, like watching TV, watching movies, FaceTiming our grandparents on the phone. So it's a very broad definition. And I think it's important that we look to the literature also to develop opinions about how it's impacting kids. Because I think my clinical opinion needs to be grounded in some research, some objective information versus just how I feel about it. And there's not, you know, there's not a ton of research on this topic. It's a hot topic, and a lot of research is either forthcoming or being just thought about. But what has been published, at least in the past couple years, has shown that lots of screen time, and again, that's TV, that's being on an iPad or an iPhone or whatever, lots of screen time, so more than 3 or 4 hours a day for a very young child, like a 1-year-old, can impact development. And the areas of development that it's really impacting tend to be communication or language. And that makes a lot of sense, because if there is something talking at you all the time, you are not going to be motivated to talk too. You are just going to be listening and watching and mesmerized by the colors on the TV or the iPad, versus using your own voice to communicate, to get your needs met, to do those things. And so that kind of makes sense. But so, you know, generally the guideline is not to expose young infants to any screen time but before the age of 18 months. After 18 months, it is recommended that no like tablet screen time is had, with the exception of FaceTiming with family, using it to communicate interactively with another person. That's totally fine and actually could have some benefits. Now, is an 18-month-old going to FaceTime you and have a conversation with you? Probably not. They're just going to look and maybe say, nah, nah, and then run the other direction. But they understand that it can be used to communicate with loved ones. So that's fine. It's really the games, the maybe the very short YouTube clips that are really bright and colorful and get their attention very quickly and then move on. Those are the sort of things that we would want to stay away from in a very young child, because it's not really doing anything. It's just right. capturing their attention, and then they're moving on to something else. And that's an age where we want to build attention skills, because let's be honest, they ain't good without screen time. So we want to get them to pay attention for longer periods of time, not get them used to these short bursts of really cool things and then moving on. So if they are exposed to any kind of screen time or digital media, you know, we recommend something that's more interactive. So something like Miss Rachel, for example. Miss Rachel, every baby loves Miss Rachel. She is fantastic. Love her. But just look at what she does. So her older videos are more interactive. So she's saying, what's this? Pausing, waiting for a response. She's teaching. She's showing, you know, this is a cow and cows go moo. She's having some sort of teaching involved in her content. So that's okay. Obviously, we still want to limit it, you know, as much as we can. But those sorts of things tend to not be as bad as the non-interactive digital media, if that right. makes sense.
I was curious because I grew up on like Sesame Street and Between the Lions and things like that, and reading Rainbow. And I feel like those shows encouraged my love of reading that I had when I was younger. And I know that, like, you know, Sesame Street or Between the Lions wasn't that created specifically for children who may not be getting that kind of teaching at home or anything. So I have been curious, as YouTube and TikTok have become such norms in families, what that kind of threshold is for screens and what's appropriate and the content that you're consuming that could help you. Because I definitely think that those shows helped me when I was younger with my imagination and with wanting to read and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, TikTok, goodness, TikTok. You know, I would stay away from that. You know, not judging anyone who's used it for their kids at all, but it goes back to the duration and the content that's expressed in TikTok. TikTok is very quick, very fast moving videos. They shuffle through them really quickly. That's just kind of how that platform gets attention from its users. That's just how it's made. You know, generally not the best thing for the developing brain. Again, I don't have a research study that's just looking at, you know, the effect of TikTok on toddler brain development. I wish that existed, but it doesn't. But we also have to use just some common sense too. Like, okay, you know, fast moving things that capture attention very quickly, things that are addicting to grown-ups probably are not that helpful for the developing brain. So let's use our common sense there. I probably wouldn't do it. And then you also have the added stress of, or the added, I would say, factor of, you know, TikTok was not made for young children. So there is a lot of content on there that is very inappropriate for children. And there's no real policing of that either. There's no regulations. There's really no way to limit your toddler's access to something that they probably shouldn't be looking at. So that would also be another reason I would stay away from it too.
I want to reiterate your point about the developing brain and the frequency of flashes and the frequency of shifting images. This is a brain that is, again, learning how the world works, including the physical world. But this frequent flashing of images does send messages to the brain that this is how the world is supposed to be, that things should go quickly, that it should be rapid fire, and I should be excited or aroused really every few seconds, because it is increasing this physiological and neurological arousal. If the developing brain grows accustomed to that, then when we think about when the developing brain needs to slow down or engage in processes that are step by step, that don't offer instant gratification, like learning to read or reading in general. So once you've learned to read, you're sitting down and reading a book, that can impact their ability to be able to focus for long periods of time to acquire knowledge and skills that we need for them to have to be successful adults and thinking adults and critically thinking adults, adults who read what is written in front of them as opposed to just copying or parroting what other people say. You got to be able to read your contract when you sign it, when you start working. We want you to be able to grow up to be a scientist or a librarian, or any type of, have any type of occupation where you would need to be able to do some reading. Even if you're working with your hands, you have to be able to create an invoice. You have to be able to pass your contractor's exam. And so the content and the way information is presented to babies can certainly impact the way their brain grows. I encourage parents to think about the screen time and the types of programming that they show their children or that they allow their children to watch, similarly to the way they would think about the types of food that they are feeding their children. We know that nutrition is a key part of brain development and body development. And so I call some shows are leafy green shows. Some shows are high in vitamins and high in nutrients, like Sesame Street or Reading Rainbow or Super Why, or even the early Miss Rachel, where she's facilitating back and forth communication and interaction. So those are high nutrients, so nutrient dense shows. Then you might have some shows that have a lot of nutrients, but they also have a lot of sugar too. So there might be some peanut butter shows, right? So Paw Patrol is teaching you about teamwork and learning some lessons about problem solving, but we're not talking about pre-academic skills as much. So that might be a peanut butter show. That might be something that we're not going to eat a whole bunch of peanut butter. We want to make sure that we have our fruits and vegetables shows, our peanut butter shows, and every once in a while you might get a donut show. You might get 5 minutes of a donut show or something that's just kind of funny and silly that does not contribute as much to the growing brain as the other shows. But I think if we shifted our focus to increasing the quality of the screen time, as Dr. Walker was saying, then there are ways that parents can kind of relieve some of that guilt or stress when it comes to allowing children to watch those screens.
Yeah. And, you know, I also think being intentional about when you do it, you know, use it to your advantage. It's a very powerful tool. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist. I have been, you know, this is my specialty. This is the population I work with. And I use screens to my advantage when I need to, when I'm trying to get ready for work and I need to have a toddler who needs some sort of interaction or something and I can't give it to him. That's when I use it. So I'm very intentional about it, and I use it to my advantage. You know, the other thing, you know, is once you show them that it exists, it's really hard to take it back. So the iPad for us, I think we've used it once on a very long car ride because my toddler remembers everything. And if he knows that he can access Miss Rachel on an iPad, then it's over. It is over. Anytime I pull that thing out or anytime I pull out my iPhone and he knows that he can get that, we're done. So try to limit that and, you know, go old school TV and use it to your advantage as much as you can because, you know, we're also practical and realistic and they serve a purpose and they can be helpful to parents too in just trying to manage, you know, taking care and raising children. So, yeah.
That's so funny that, well, not funny, but you bring up comparing the screens to the different types of food and then also using screens to your advantage. I feel like that's exactly what my parents did during the week. I could watch 1 hour of PBS Kids after school. And that was like while they were getting dinner ready or while they were whatever. And then on the weekends, Saturday mornings, that's when I could watch SpongeBob. And that was also when they did whatever they needed to do around the house, or I had a sister that's 5 years younger than me so they could tend to her. And that balance, like you get more excited to watch SpongeBob when you know you only get to watch it on Saturdays, you know.
They probably tried to sleep in or drink a cup of coffee in peace when you were watching SpongeBob. That's what they did with it.
And I'm sure SpongeBob hearing that from the living room really contributed to their peace, I'm sure. Well, I know that we need to wrap up. This has been so great. Is there anything that we did not talk about that you want to make sure that you leave with the people before we go?
Dr. Banks said at the very beginning, she talked about not putting the onus so much on an individual parent. So a parent who's stressed, a parent who's just struggling. And I think that that is really important because a lot of the times we say, well, a mom has postpartum depression. She just needs to go to therapy. Do you know how hard it is to go to therapy when you are trying to breastfeed a 2-week-old or a 3-week-old newborn? Forget about it. It's not going to happen. But there are some things that we can do as a community to support new parents. And some of that does include, you know, being an advocate for things that support infant early childhood mental health, like parental leave policies. It's only natural to want to be home with your newborn baby. It's not really fair for a new mom to have to go back to work a week after she delivers because she has to provide for her family and make sure that her baby has diapers and food to eat when really that's a period of connection and bonding that you want to have with your baby. So I think as a community, we can lift up and support new parents better. I think that's something that if we want to support young children and their mental health and have them reach their optimal development, that's something that we have to do and quit putting that all on an individual parent to figure out themselves. It's very hard. They are raising a new human. What can we do as a community to support them in helping their child reach their full potential?
And I would also add that we don't have to let the old ways dictate the new ways or dictate our future. Oftentimes we hear families say or hear parents say, well, that's how my parents did it, or that's how I was raised. Let's cut everybody some slack and let's also be transparent and say that not everybody did the best thing. They might have done the best that they can do, that they could do, but they might have made some mistakes because they're humans and humans make mistakes. And our parents and our grandparents and our great grandparents were all parenting for the first time. They hadn't done this before. And so there are ways that we can take the love and support and experiences that we've had and appreciate our parents and caregivers for the way that they raised us. And we can also add to that. And so if we, and I'm just taking this from Dr. Walker, who on an offline call said that if you're doing so well now, imagine how well your child could be if you added these new skills to your parenting repertoire. So if you're doing well based on what your parents did with you, imagine how well your child could do if you take what you learned from your parents and added this new knowledge to the way that you're raising and caring for your child. And that way, what we're doing is supporting future generations. We're supporting our children to be better than us. What's better? We want a better life for them, even if our lives were fantastic. We want them to have an even more fantastic life. And I think that resonates with individuals who care for children. So it doesn't mean that you are blaming your parents or the people who raised you by shifting and adding some other pieces to your parenting repertoire.
That I come from a healthy two-parent home, and after every single one of my therapy sessions, my parents are like, I'm so glad you're doing that, because then you can do better on your kids than we did with you, and you're already, you know, to them, they think I'm wonderful. So I think that is a really important message for a lot of parents to hear, that you don't have to do exactly as your parents did. It's okay to be innovative or learn, take in new information and apply it to your own family. Well, thank y'all so much. This has been so enlightening. I'm so grateful that y'all were able to share with me and take time to chat. The insights that you've provided today will undoubtedly help so many families and caregivers create environments where children in Mississippi can thrive. And thank you to everyone who tuned into our Chat About Children podcast. Be sure to check out Mississippi Lift and what that's all about, and the Children's Foundation of Mississippi for more resources and updates. Our website is childrensfoundationms.org, and we are on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and YouTube. So be sure to check out the descriptions for all of our social media handles.